You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, June 28th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. The Supreme Court has spoken. What did they say? I don't know. Well, I do know. But I mean, really, what did they really say? On the program today to explain it to us, Professor Amanda Frost from American University, Washington School of Law, will be joining us to... Well, we know the basic outlines of the ruling today. What are the implications going forward? We will talk to her about that. And, of course, we'll open it up to your phone calls, I think, a little bit early today and your IMs. A lot of people have many thoughts about this today. Of course, the top line announcement today is that the Affordable Care Act was found constitutional, not necessarily on the grounds that we would want it to have been under the Commerce Clause. And there's also questions as to the government's ability to leverage an existing program to require the states to adopt an expansion of that program. All of this will make much more sense when we speak to our guest, I think. But first off, let's get a little meta here. There was something like almost 400,000 people on SCOTUS blog following what the SCOTUS bloggers were writing in their real-time reporting of the case. I had numerous... streams that accidentally seemed to pick up the news channels. I'm not exactly sure how that happened. But, CNN, which prides itself on being the most trusted name in news, in covering the news, as opposed to commentating on it, theoretically, they really got this one wrong. Now, of course, Fox did too, but I mean, it's Fox. But CNN had some major, major egg on their face. Here's a compilation via, I think it was Talking Points memo, on both Fox and CNN getting it way, way wrong.
Oh boy. We have breaking news here on the Fox News Channel.
Hold on a second. Kate Baldwin has got some information. Kate, go ahead. Tell us what's going on.
This is our first reading. We're still going through the reading, the opinion, but I want to bring you the breaking news that according to producer Bill Mears, the individual mandate is not a valid exercise of the Commerce Clause. So it appears as if the Supreme Court justices have struck down the individual mandate, the centerpiece of the healthcare legislation.
The individual mandate has been ruled
unconstitutional.
I'm going to hop back on this phone to try to get more information for you and bring it right to you, Wolf.
Wow, that's a dramatic moment. If, in fact, the Supreme Court has ruled that the individual mandate is, in fact, unconstitutional, that would be history unfolding right now.
That means the mandate is gone.
It raises questions about any of this health care reform law.
The court striking down that mandate is a dramatic blow to the policy and to the president. The justices have just gutted, Wolf, the centerpiece provision of the Obama health care law. The question now is, what else do they say in this ruling, and can parts of the law be salvaged? A direct blow to the president of the United States, a direct blow to his Democratic Party.
Yeah, if in fact that's the final word on the individual mandate, it could be a little bit more complicated.
We're getting conflicting information. We're getting conflicting information.
As I say, there's some confusion out there, conflicting reports coming in from inside the Supreme Court. So let's hold off on drawing any final conclusions on what exactly the nine justices of the U.S. Supreme Court have decided.
Oh, dude, you didn't have my computer on. Wow. Talk about not just CNN failing. Ready? Let's try it one more time. All right, folks. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Amanda Frost on this ruling of huge import. I mean, regardless of whether or not you support the structure of this law, this was a very big case, and very surprising in that Chief Justice Roberts ended up being the fifth vote in validating the Affordable Care Act as opposed to Justice Kennedy. We'll take a break. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Professor Amanda Frost from the American University Washington School of Law. Well, welcome to the program, Professor.
Glad to be here.
Now, we spoke, I guess it was now months ago, during the debate, the arguments in front of the Supreme Court regarding the Affordable Care Act, and give me the top line of your sense of the ruling today.
First, the court upheld the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, meaning the entire law will go into effect. But I think it did so in an unusual and somewhat extraordinary way, in that it said five justices said that the Congress did not have power under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, which is the clause that much of the social welfare legislation that Congress passes is enacted under. So that was a surprise. The court upheld the law under the taxing power that Congress has. And so that was a surprise. And then, of course, the fact that the five votes came from the four liberal justices joined by Chief Justice Roberts was also, at least for me, a surprise.
Okay, now let's go. I want to go through the four major questions that the court looked at today. And what strikes me is weird. Just starting off, the first one was the one that we didn't pay much attention to at the time. People thought it would be sort of ridiculous for the court to have taken this case and scheduled so much time on oral arguments. But there was a question, the first question the court had to decide, and I believe the first question that the arguments were made was whether or not the question of the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act could be addressed under the Anti-Injunction Act. And this is what I find very interesting. Well, explain to us what the Anti-Injunction Act is.
Sure. The Anti-Injunction Act is a federal statute that says that you cannot challenge a tax before it is collected, that the case cannot be heard until after the tax is collected. And then after you pay your taxes, you can challenge the payment and get the money back if you win. But you're not allowed to bring a legal challenge to a tax before that tax is collected. And the purpose of that is so that we don't disrupt our taxation system.
Okay. Now, if the court found that the mandate is, in fact, a tax, essentially, that one pays if one doesn't have insurance, how come the Anti-Injunction Act didn't come into play here?
Yeah, it's a great question. And basically, the court split the baby. It said this provision, the individual mandate that makes you buy insurance or pay a penalty, can be justified as an exercise of Congress's power to tax under the Constitution. But it is not a tax for the purposes of the Anti-Injunction Act, which is a statute, because the court said for the purposes of that statute, what matters is how Congress labeled what it did. And Congress did not consider the individual mandate to be a tax. It didn't label it as a tax. And it wasn't trying to invoke the Anti-Injunction Act's limiting principle about when you can sue when it created the individual mandate. So the Congress's label, which was not to call it a tax but to call it a penalty, was the key issue for the Anti-Injunction Act part of the case. But in terms of where Congress had the authority under the Constitution, the court said it is a tax. So it's split the baby. It's a tax for the purposes of Congress's constitutional authority, not a tax for the purposes of the Anti-Injunction Act.
Okay, and that seems like a lot of like pretzel twisting, isn't it, or no?
Well, certainly I can understand why you say that, but I guess for me, I thought it actually made sense logically because the point is Congress has the power under the statute, the Anti-Injunction Act, to decide what kind of legal challenges can go forward and what can't. And in fact, Congress, if it wanted to, could have said in this health care law, the Affordable Care Act, we're going to call this a tax, but don't consider it a tax for the purposes of the Anti-Injunction Act.
Okay.
Or make an exception to the Anti-Injunction Act. They had the power to do that. And so what the court said is by labeling a penalty, they essentially were doing that. They were saying don't apply the Anti-Injunction Act.
Okay. Because it's statutory, it doesn't have the same sort of bar to clear as if it was constitutional.
Yeah. Congress has power to decide under its statutes what it wants to do. And it, by calling it a penalty, decided not to make the Anti-Injunction Act applicable.
Okay, fair enough. So let's go to the question of the mandate. This is what are the implications? Well, first of all, we'll talk about sort of the meta stuff afterwards. But what are the implications in terms of the Commerce Clause going forward? Because while the finding that the government has the right to impose this mandate under the context of it being a tax, the fact that the government didn't have the right to impose this mandate under the Commerce Clause could theoretically have some very big implications going forward.
Certainly, and I think that is somewhat an open question. In other words, the fact that five votes on the court said Congress lacked the Commerce Clause authority to enact this legislation, does that suggest that social welfare legislation going forward will be struck down under the Commerce Clause as not being legitimate under the Commerce Clause? I tend to think it's not going to be a bar to future social welfare legislation, that this opinion's Commerce Clause provision discussion will not bar future social welfare legislation, because the court made it really clear its problem with the individual mandate was that it was not regulating commercial activity. And the court said it was creating commercial activity, and that's not something Congress can do under the Commerce Clause. Most social welfare legislation wouldn't have that problem. It's clearly regulating a broad definition anyway of commercial activity. So I don't see a lot of social welfare legislation being challenged under this precedent.
Would it bar would their finding and the five here, to be clear, is who are the five that found it not upholdable under the Commerce Clause?
The Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Kennedy, Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, and Justice Scalia.
So would this bar, for instance, going forward, a plan to privatize Social Security? In other words, if part of Social Security became you must put some of this money into a mutual fund, let's say, would this precedent in terms of the capacity for government would this bar something like privatizing Social Security or Medicare for that matter?
Well,
because that seems to be part of like the voucher system that Paul Ryan is suggesting.
You know, it's a really interesting question. I'd have to see the legislation, but I could see the argument that the Commerce Clause provision of this opinion would bar it, but then Congress could structure it as a tax penalty, right? So Congress could say you must invest every month part of your paycheck in a private, investment fund of some kind for retirement account, and if you don't, you will pay a tax penalty. And if they structured it that way, it would be upheld under this precedent. But I agree, it's possible that they would say, well, that's trying to create economic activity, that is creating an IRA, investment retirement account, that doesn't exist, and therefore the Commerce Clause doesn't allow it. There might, depending on how it's worded and structured, be a Commerce Clause problem, but then Congress could get around that through its taxing power based on this precedent.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, yes, there's an opportunity to get around it, but of course, then you have to own the idea of increasing taxes, which would have, I think, severe implications on the type of on the people who would push for such a privatization. That is an interesting sort of, I guess, side note. What other practical effects do you think that the Commerce Clause restrictions would have? I mean, is there any, for instance, I know that there have been rulings in terms of the federal government's authority to police marijuana growing that have invoked the Commerce Clause. Where would that case, if it was to show up again, where would that case fall in this case under this ruling?
You know, I think the Commerce Clause precedent would not be affected by this decision because it looks a lot like this Wickard versus Stillburn case from, you know, way back early in our nation's history where the court upheld Congress's regulation of a wheat farmer who was growing wheat allegedly just for his own family's consumption. And the argument was Congress lacked authority under the Commerce Clause to prohibit or bar him from growing wheat in that way because it's just for his own consumption and therefore it's not part of interstate commerce. And the court upheld Congress's power to regulate an individual's growing of a crop, even for their own family's consumption, on the ground that, you know, everybody's decision to grow their own wheat would indeed affect the interstate commerce in buying and selling wheat. So I think similarly, you could justify Congress's power to regulate and prohibit marijuana growth and consumption. So I don't see this decision as affecting that line of Commerce Clause jurisprudence.
Is there any other that it strikes you? I mean, obviously, you know, we're an hour and a half out from the ruling, and so I imagine you haven't had a chance to completely comb through this with a fine tooth comb.
Yeah.
But is there anything else that occurred to you that that the ruling relative to the Commerce Clause will have an impact going forward, or would cause anyone to revisit any of the decisions that were made in the past based on the Commerce Clause?
You know, As you say, I haven't had enough time to digest this, nor I think do any of us know where the court may take the 5-4 decision on that Commerce Clause question in the future. I do know, though, that I thought the government had good arguments about why, indeed, the decision not to buy health insurance and to self-insure, essentially, meaning if you get ill and you go into the hospital and you either pay for it yourself or you go bankrupt, why that was commerce. I think the government had good arguments, and the fact that the court is not willing to see that as commerce means that in the future, attempts to regulate people who are imposing costs on the rest of us through their inactivity, those Congress may be on weak ground when it tries to do that in the future, try to regulate people who, through failure to take steps to protect themselves, impose costs on the rest of us. Congress may not be able to do that in the future, and so I think there is some limits that have been set out by this decision. It's hard to see them having any sweeping application right now. I think most social welfare legislation can be justified as regulating ongoing commercial activity in even the more narrow way the court views it.
And the third question that was argued in front of the court had to do with the severability of the mandate from the rest of the legislation. And I imagine because it was found constitutional under the taxing powers, that became sort of a moot question.
Exactly. The severability question was only relevant if the court found some part of the statute to be unconstitutional. And since it upheld the individual mandate under the taxing power, it did not need to reach the severability question.
All right, so we come to the fourth question, which at the time of the arguments in front of the Supreme Court, I found that this question was the sort of the most baffling as to whether or not why the court would have taken this question, and that was whether or not the government could force states to expand Medicare, and in this case they're basically Medicaid. They're paying 90% of the costs, at least for the first 3 or 4 years. It's an existing program, and the government was basically saying, we're going to expand Medicaid, and if you don't accept the expansion of that Medicaid, then you lose funding for the entire program. Is that did I characterize that properly?
You did, and that is indeed how most people read the statute, and of course the court basically reinterpreted it to uphold it here.
Well, now, how did they uphold that, or did they how did they interpret that question?
Basically, what they said is we read the statute differently. We read the statute to say that if a state chooses to reject the expansion and not to give expanded coverage to citizens to more citizens than they currently do under the current Medicaid laws, so that is the laws in effect before the Affordable Care Act was enacted. If states choose to reject the Affordable Care Act's expansion, they will lose any federal funding to cover that expansion, but they will not lose all of their federal funding for Medicaid.
So in other words, the court read the statute as being an entirely different, program. And is that basically what it was?
Well, yes, although, I mean, I think that they said it wasn't, you know, they felt it was legitimate to read it that way. So they wouldn't say they wrote a new statute. They would say it was possible to read the statute that way.
And therefore, you cannot leverage the existence of a pre-existing program. You cannot use that as leverage in forcing the states to accept a second program.
Exactly. And I think part of the concern, that part of the reason they reached out to read the statute that way is they felt there was constitutional problems with the level of coercion that would occur were Congress to say, expand Medicaid as we are requiring, asking you to do, or you lose all of your funding for all of Medicaid. The court was concerned that would transgress constitutional lines by being coercive and forcing the states to do something they didn't want to do. So to avoid that problem, they read the statute as eliminating the federal funding for expanding Medicaid, but not as taking away all Medicaid funding from states that refuse to expand coverage.
Now, but how is that reconciled with the idea of, I remember back in my salad days when President Reagan said, raise your drinking age to 21 or don't get any federal highway funds. How is that different?
Well, I mean, first of all, there are some limits on Congress's power to what they call attached conditions to spending, and that is that, you know, the program has to be related to the spending, which is true in both cases, right? The drinking age is somewhat related to federal funding for highways, I suppose, and the drunk driving is a problem, et cetera. And, of course, more clearly, the Medicaid funding here that was at issue is related to the expansion of Medicaid, directly related. There's not a relationship problem. And, your point about South Carolina versus Dole, the case you just mentioned involving the drinking age and the federal highway funding, suggesting Congress can eliminate funding for a broad range of activity if states don't comply. I think you're right. I think that precedent could have supported a different decision here. It could have supported the court saying it's constitutional and legitimate for Congress to condition all of Medicaid funding on a state's willingness to expand its program and cover more people. But I guess this court wanted to make it clear to Congress there are limits on its spending power, and it therefore read the statute more narrowly.
But I mean, how could Congress? How could Congress have a clear notion of where their limits are, knowing that in one instance they're able to leverage a pre-existing program, right, highway funds, with the ongoing receiving of those funds, which I assume the funding is going to change from year to year, right? I mean, maybe one year it's more, maybe one year it's less. With a rider that you need to, impose some other aspect of driving, let's say, or some other piece of legislation. I mean, how could Congress possibly have clarity on this point at this, after this ruling?
Yeah, I mean, we could talk about the distinctions, and certainly Medicaid is a larger portion of, my understanding is a larger portion of states' budgets than is the federal funding for highways, and in fact, Medicaid is a big state expenditure, and the federal funds are a very important part of the state's ability to afford that. So we can make arguments like that. But your main question is, well, how can Congress know where constitutional limits are and constitutional lines are drawn? And of course they don't. And that's because there's shifting political alliances, shifting understanding of what the Constitution says and means, shifting interpretations of the Constitution, shifting membership on the court. And so I think Congress and the court never quite know where they stand. And indeed, right, we just had a law that Congress passed where we were all waiting with bated breath to see whether the court would uphold it, and a lot of people thought they'd strike it down. So Congress enacts legislation that comes close to constitutional lines and doesn't know what the court will do.
And
part of our system.
Do you see any other implications in terms of had Congress simply not forget the moment that we call it the Affordable Care Act, forget the idea of the mandate? Had Congress simply said, we are now going to change the eligibility requirements for Medicaid, it is now going to be, 150% of poverty. Forget the Affordable Care Act ever existed. Would the Supreme Court have found that, and if you do not expand Medicaid in this fashion, you have a choice. You either opt out of the program or you opt into the program. The program is now this. We pay for health insurance for people at 150% of poverty. Would the Supreme Court, based upon their ruling today, have found that unconstitutional?
I'm not sure of your question. Your question is if it wasn't taken out of the political context in which it was.
Well, I mean, I guess if it was distinct. I mean, my understanding is that the Supreme Court found this to be essentially a separate program, that you couldn't leverage the pre-existing funding for Medicaid based upon, you could only essentially say you could only threaten not to fund the expansion of Medicaid as opposed to the existence of the pre-existing Medicaid program. If they had defined it, if Congress had explicitly defined it as not the Affordable Care Act, as not an additional program, but rather simply just a change in the pre-existing Medicaid, would that have had would that have affected the ruling?
Yeah, no, I don't think it would have made a difference. I mean, I think Congress, in enacting this statute, would have said there's an existing Medicaid program that covers people up to X percent of poverty, and now we're making the states cover people up to 133% of the federal poverty line. And if you don't do that, then you lose all of your Medicare funding. I think the same logic would have applied. The court would have said the same thing that it did in this Affordable Care Act opinion in the hypothetical you describe. I don't think that would have made a difference.
And so would this allow, under this ruling, could theoretically the federal government could say, okay, we're going to diminish our funding for Medicaid. It doesn't have the same coercive effects, I guess, is the idea. In other words, it's not a question of it's a question of compelling the states to spend more. Does this open the door for states to sort of really cherry pick what programs and what aspects of programs they're going to?
I think it puts states that challenge this law in an odd position or an awkward position, because the federal government is paying 90% to 100% of the cost of expansion. And so I can't see why states would be perfectly happy and why their citizens shouldn't demand that those states agree to be part of this expansion, because it's a boon to the state citizens who will be covered by the new provisions who otherwise wouldn't have health insurance and certainly wouldn't have federal paid for health insurance. So I think most people want to participate in this. The question would come, let's say, in 10 years from now, if Congress says, oops, we really don't have the funding for this anymore. States, we're going to require you keep these people in Medicaid, but you have to pay for it now. And when that happens, the states may choose to reevaluate whether they want to expand Medicaid. Mr. Stater, I have to say, I'm free to do another interview at 12:30.
Oh, sure.
I was told this was 5 to 10 minutes, so I think I need to take the phone call. I'm just getting now.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much for taking the time with us. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right. So there you have it, folks. I think most states are going to take the expansion of Medicaid, but it's undoubtedly you're going to get a state that's, you know, like, I don't know, Texas or South Carolina or some state that is going to sort of say, like, you know, stick it. We're not going to do this. This is going to infringe upon our freedom to have people basically die in the street. We have to accept that poor people are going to die just because they're poor.
Alabama, Louisiana, any of those?
Indeed. All right. Well, look, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, yeah, well, you know what? We're going to head into the post show. But we will take your phone calls right now. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. I'm actually surprised that we got anybody who could talk at this point, because everybody we reached out to, you know, I wanted to get multiple people on to talk about this. They're either writing their analysis of the SCOTUS decision, or they're on another program. And so I was happy that we could get Professor Frost. 646-257-3920. Folks, call in. There's still a lot of people who are pissed that this passed, and we will be talking about the political implications of this passing in the better half of the program. I want to hear your response. It is apparently a lot of conservatives are going to be moving up to Canada now and enjoying the benefits of, I guess, single-payer health care coverage. Up there.
For those who don't know what Sam's talking about, do a Twitter search for moving to Canada.
Yeah, you can search moving to Canada on conservative. I mean, I imagine if you're a conservative now, you're going to be trying to move to Somalia or something, right? I mean, that's the one last place you get freedom. All right, folks. You can support this program by becoming a member. It is your membership that keeps any part of this program alive, frankly. If we had no members, it wouldn't be just that you wouldn't get the extra 50 minutes a day. There would just be no show. In fact, if we had even... Well, I don't want to freak anybody out, but we need membership. Let's put it that way. And you can join at majority.fm. You can also support this program by going to majority.fm, clicking on support the show, find the Amazon link, click it, bookmark it, always buy your Amazon crap through that link. We get a small kickback. Also, do you drink coffee? Do you eat chocolate? Do you drink tea? JustCoffee.coop. You should be drinking coffee where people aren't exploited to put that coffee. I mean, there's very few things that you can consume in our society where somebody hasn't been exploited to provide it for you. Just Coffee is one of the few things that you can enjoy knowing that everybody involved in the process has been fairly compensated. From the people who shipped it to you, the people who set up the website, to the people who pick it. And you get a 10% discount with the coupon code MAJORITY. You can buy the Majority Report blend.
Give us a review on iTunes.
Yeah.
Apple just released a podcast app, so I have to assume they're going to really start focusing on podcasts, which means those reviews help us go up in the podcast rankings.
Yes.
And people will discover the Majority Report if they haven't already discovered it.
You can actually help other people find this show by giving us a review on iTunes. If everybody listened to the show, gave us a review on iTunes, we would be at the top of the charts.
Members, you too. Even if you're not getting that free show on iTunes, still go there and leave the review there.
Good point, Matt. Well done.
You're welcome.
We also have merch. DonateYourAccount.com. What else? Oh, tomorrow on the program, Cliff Schechter, Michael Ian Black.
Ooh.
We'll give us a movie review. All right. Join me in the better half. Give us a phone call, 646-257-3920. We'll be right back.